The Distributed Gesamtkunstwerk, Sound, Worlding, and New Media Culture by Thomas Rickert and Michael J. Salvo, Purdue University, West Lafayette, Indiana. A note about the authors. Fans and failed performers of a variety of musical styles, Thomas Rickert and Michael J. Salvo try the patience of graduate and undergraduate students and produce rhetoric programs with apocryphal tales of near rock and roll glory. Sound and music have haunted them, missing elements of multimodal literacy ready to join discussions of new media. This is the first project they've written together. Both helped establish online new media journals in the mid-1990s and have longed for the kind of community activity and collaborative thinking this early digital work demanded as they established Enculturation and Kairos as viable online publishing venues. This project has reminded them both that they are not above nostalgia. Abstract. This essay argues that musicians have been at the forefront of the multimedia revolution. Rather than limit multimedia's creative locus to individuals working with a small range of tools, instruments, we address the increasing dispersion of productive processes across communities, technologies, and spaces. New media culture has reached a point where one can compose on a laptop, sample, loop, and create mashups and heretofore unknown musics. These developments indicate that contemporary remixed digital music culture offers vocabularies, models, and practices for new media writing and culture generations beyond the tradition of text-based composition or the singular work of art. This article traces a genealogy from Wagner's notion of the total artwork up to contemporary digital remix to show how new media extend techniques that have long been developing. Just as the dispersion of production across communities and technologies transforms musical aesthetics, so also the aesthetic experience itself changes. New media culture is less resonant with interpretation than with engagement, and to explain this experiential difference, the article develops the concepts of worlding and prosumer. Additionally, this article considers musical and multimedia attempts to incorporate new input streams, including those too often categorized and excluded as noise. Such input streams, in combination with other feedback-driven and distributed forms of production, can be theorized as part of an expansive, immersive, and experiential approach to new media we articulate as worlding. Keywords: Brian Eno, Distributed Cognition, Feedback, The Flaming Lips, Garage Band, Gesamtkunstwerk, Music, Multimedia, New Media, Prosumer, Total Artwork, Yes. 1. Introduction. We want to change the way you think about sound. If we wish to attempt this by grounding ourselves in classical high culture, we might begin with Richard Wagner's idea of the total artwork and establish this as a key musical source for understanding what today we call multimedia. We could claim that already at the end of Romanticism and at the dawn of the modern aesthetic, Wagner was marshaling multiple media in order to generate an immersive experience for the audience. Wagner's idea of the total artwork brought every aspect of a musical dramatic work under direct compositional control in order to give it its most complete performance. If we were to establish this as a key genealogical moment, such a linking would usefully provide a powerful resonance between contemporary remix digital culture and early forms of musical showmanship. Indeed, the 2001 edited collection, Multimedia from Wagner to Virtual Reality, has implicitly made this argument, tying Wagner's idea about the total artwork to other aesthetic advancements in music, painting, theater, and film. Randall Packer and Ken Jordan, however, were interested in the advent of virtual reality. Our pathway here is different. We are interested in production and composition, not as the evocation of a virtual realm, but as the aesthetic and especially musical evocation of a world. Rather than see technology moving us toward notions of virtuality, we want to remain grounded in a concrete world, regardless of possible fictionalized content. We want to know what worlds are evoked in sound, how melody, image, noise, beat, genre, fanfare, and band persona prepare a participating listener or user to experience a soundscape, a created world of sensual information. We argue that new media increasingly create these sensory experiences by marshaling a variety of technologies, not as a virtual world qua consensual hallucination, but through a sense of worlding that further collapses the distinction between real and virtual. From our vantage point, writing in 2005-2006, we see from the 1960s onward numerous examples of proto-multimedia, from the earliest attempts at multimedia with the technologies of the day to the hip happenings, from poorly lit jam sessions to candle-lit slideshows accompanied by music, Andy Warhol and the Velvet Underground, to the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper. And whether or not we might want to claim some direct causal relation, some genetic link, Wagner's far-reaching ideas about total art, ideas we are transposing as proto-multimedia composition and presumption, suffuse great swaths of this work. The Beatles are particularly exemplary. They achieved unprecedented aesthetic and commercial success as they evolved from being uniquely skilled songwriters to orchestrators of multimedia keyed to music and lifestyle. They created characters in the Sgt. Pepper album, went on stage under pseudonyms in Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Heart Club Band, even moved into film, such as A Hard Day's Night, Help, and Yellow Submarine, which saw the Sgt. Pepper characters appear in animated form. When Wagner ranks of total art in the 19th century, he could not have imagined how far such ideas might go, how, with broadcast technology and the Ed Sullivan Show, stage makeup and garish costumes, a film and a brand, these ideas would help the Beatles become an aesthetic juggernaut, selling truckloads of albums and movie tickets, packing stadiums, and later, with John and Yoko, galvanizing the anti-war movement by proselytizing for peace. Nor could Wagner have imagined, a theme we will return to, the emergence of the new media forms artists would utilize to expand their musical vision beyond the bounds of what is just music. Such expansion speaks to the movement away from the singular cult of genius propagated by Wagner and his fellow romanticists, and toward distributed forms of production. To replay our leitmotif, musicians have been at the forefront of the new media revolution, and as our brief example of the Beatles illustrates, and as we will show below with Jimi Hendrix, yes, Brian Eno, and the Flaming Lips, artists and musicians have been collaborating and mutually influencing each other, creating feedback loops and immersive media worlds for quite some time. Wagner's control over set design, lighting, and costuming as fulfilling and furthering the aesthetic reach of his music compares favorably to the Beatles creating imaginary characters, selecting album cover art, collaborating on movie scripts and costume design, and producing films, also with the idea of fulfilling and furthering their aesthetic reach. Furthermore, there is a technological component to these extensions, dispersions, and feedback loops, a counterpoint that transforms the singular humanism Wagner brought to his conception of the total artwork. We thereby move from the cult of the virtuoso or romantic genius that holds apart the realm of art from the common and everyday to a postmodern, post-punk, remix, hip-hop culture that values and utilizes all sound that punctuate common experience and brings art back into the everyday. Such an approach transvalues, reuses, and repackages content, sound, styles, and more, while also scrambling our sense of borrowed and originary. Such a culture fosters the full emergence of the prosumer. This term, originally coined by Alvin Toffler in his 1980 book The Third Wave, but enjoying a resurgence, captures the emergence of practices that join together the formerly separate categories of consumer and producer. As we trace theoretically and historically some key moments in the evolution of musical sound, on the one hand we describe sound's networking with multimedia, whereby sound seeks to propagate its aesthetic worlding through alternate media forms, and on the other hand we trace the breakdown, akin to Barthes' distinction between writerly, readerly texts, of what it means to make something and what it means to use or enjoy it. It is our supposition that these two strands go together, and that it is no accident that they have evolved and co-adapted together as they have. Perhaps all this is to say that we have not yet sufficiently attended to the technological nature of our mediated world. While it is a commonplace that new technologies impact our understanding and practice of communication, we are still only beginning to appreciate how the advent and cross-pollination of multimedia forms transform our world and our sense of world. Perhaps all this is to say that we have not yet sufficiently attended to the technological nature of our mediated world. While it is a commonplace that new technologies impact our understanding and practice of communication, we are still only beginning to appreciate how the advent and cross-pollination of multiple media forms transform our world and our sense of world, the hundreds of books, scholarly and populist, notwithstanding. In looking to theorize, historicize, and bring into pedagogical practice sound itself, as the call for papers that inspired this essay asked, we find ourselves playing catch-up to innovations and techniques that have long been in the wind in the world of music. That, we suspect, is one of the largest, if unspoken, thoughts underpinning the call to bring sound into what has heretofore been almost exclusively a text-based field of inquiry and pedagogy. In other words, it is not simply a matter of the computer and other electronica making sound a greater cultural and scholarly concern, nor simply a matter of the integration of media forms, even if these factors are of tremendous import and ones with which we will engage. Rather, it is that the move to inquire into sound brings with it a necessary willingness to learn its techniques and aesthetics, which are quite different from those of text and image, and insofar as sound has in fact been continually merged with other media forms, this complicates, or we might even say complexifies, even further what we mean by sound, and extends the range and import of those techniques and aesthetics. This essay does not offer recipes for insertion into existing technology-rich composition curricula. It is a grounding assumption on our part that such recipes are of limited utility. Rather, we are asking readers to reflect on how they think about and interact with music, rock and avant-garde music in particular, especially in terms of their experiences with the relationships among oral elements, music, sound, and noise. Such an approach that transforms how we conceive and in turn, presumably how we hear and experience sound, promises far more for composition, invention, and pedagogy. The essay traces the co-developing trajectories of technologies and techniques that define styles and development and in hindsight become music history. Our inspiration comes from our own idiosyncratic relationships to popular and not so popular musical expression, to relationships among bands, and from our understanding of and participation in communities of taste. As we have experienced, our students experiment with identities co-produced by fans and artists amid sounds, images, and communities. In this article, we have named this complexly interrelated matrix of community and identity formation, transformative technologies, and the practices it gives rise to, worlding. Worlding is key for understanding how new media and its technologies are differentiated from text and its technologies because it describes an entirely different way of experiencing production and reception, and we find that sound is, perhaps surprisingly, crucial for understanding worlding. End of part one. Part 2. Feedbacking Hendrix, or what's all this have to do with composition? Jimi Hendrix's use of feedback, whereby sound vibrations from an electric instrument like a guitar get picked up and fed again through the amplification system, illustrates in a germinal form characteristics essential for understanding today's digital and remix aesthetics, while also linking quite concretely with debates about modeling communications pathways. Arguably the most revolutionary guitarist of the 20th century, one of Hendrick's most important contributions was the use of volume to generate a particular kind of noise, feedback, and the development of techniques for controlling and integrating noise and feedback into a musical setting. This impacts our understanding of communicational models. For example, the clear cybernetic telephony model of Claude Shannon and Warren Weaver. Contra Shannon and Weaver, for Hendrick, noise is not a source of contamination or something to be eliminated, but rather an integral input stream, a source of information worthy of inclusion and manipulation. The roiling harmonics and waves feedback generate sounds akin to ghosts in the sonic landscape, and Shannon and Weaver's noise now becomes musical. These ghosts, musical or otherwise, are intertextual residues or traces of an excess that will not be repressed or squeegeed. While Hendrix was not the only one developing such new aesthetics, Hendrix's influence in particular has been massive to the point where scores of artists, such as Sonic Youth, Glenn Branca, My Bloody Valentine, Ride, Sigur Rós, and more, have formulated entire feedback-based aesthetics. While not all artists go so far, it has at least become a commonplace to incorporate formerly unacknowledged, if not illegitimate, forms of sound and label them legitimate, thereby reimagining noise as input. If it is not yet clear, we want to underscore that we are not merely discussing the musical incorporation of noise. Rather, we are suggesting that such techniques can productively be adopted in composition classrooms, at the very least in terms of expanding our techniques for invention. In some ways, this might be considered a bricolage-like aesthetic of merging different idioms, such as transforming noise into signal and finding new sources of input, as world music strives to do. By multiplying the legitimate sources of music or production in general, we counter the tendency to create a separate world of art and aesthetics, blurring distinction between art and not art, to the point where we can dwell interactively in musico-aesthetic spaces without consigning ourselves exclusively to the aesthetic realm. We thereby come to appreciate the materials already surrounding us in the postmodern fashion of radically expanding the sources and agencies involved in theorizing and conducting creative endeavors. We might offer, then, a series of revised communicative models that attempt to grapple with the incorporation of noise, the generation of feedback, and the blurring of genre boundaries. First, here is a model loosely affiliated with what Hendrix accomplished. See Figure 2. The feedback here may well be undifferentiated and messy. We understand it as captured in the moment and rebroadcast through the same electronics that generated it. And in this way, it reformulates or rearticulates noise as signal. Such a model values what might have been categorized as waste. We might say, in fine postmodern fashion, that noise is simply a new move in the communicative game, but one that also, in accordance with the principles of feedback, changes the nature of the game. Having moved from dismissing feedback as noise to valuing feedback as input, we follow recent musical composition practice in articulating a variety of sources of feedback. By articulating these sources of feedback, we move toward valuing them as we name and differentiate their source and use. As John Dan Johnson Alola reminded us, Shannon and Weaver were describing the technical specifications for effective long-distance communication. But as Michelle Serres indicated in The Parasite, there are different kinds of noise, forms of which can be made helpful. The dial tone, for instance, is a noise that provides feedback. It functions as an indication that the system is ready to place an outgoing call. In French, the dial tone is called le parasite, the parasite, and it is a useful noise accorded a particular value and an idiosyncratic label. And in fact, it becomes a new input string. Below, labels in Figure 3 name useful forms of feedback. Hendrix electronic static, crowd noise that indicates a track was recorded in front of a live audience. samples and loops that have gained prominence in hip-hop and house music, natural and other sounds occurring in man-made environments and captured for later use, as well as visual art and other media input, including writing. Feedback, then, can take myriad forms, and we show here a few we can recognize and name to illustrate a point. We have moved from a first-order cybernetic sense of the technical need to eliminate noise in the communicative process, to valuing noise produced by the creation of musical sound, to recognizing that noise comes from numerous sources rather than a single source, to naming and distinguishing a variety of these sources. We are not so much advocating the use of sound in compositions, as we are looking to music culture to gain inspiration and models that are applicable to new media. That is, we are remixing written composition so that it learns from musical culture and takes it as a valued source. Let us not forget all the parents in 1964 American households covering their ears exclaiming, "What is this noise?" when hearing the Beatles for the first time. Just as German parents wondered upon hearing Wagner for the first time, "Was ist das Geräusch?" that is, "What is this noise?" With time, Wagner has found his total artwork enshrined among other high art, brimming with cultural capital, while the Beatles are in the midst of a similar sanctification. Yes, may yet be waiting a while. End of part two. Part 3, Going for the One, Yes as Postmodern Gesamtkunstwerk. We have suggested that the Beatles, moving from songwriters to orchestrators of multiple media forms, further Wagner's ideas concerning the total artwork by developing alternate persona, working in film and animation, and ultimately transforming the very notion of what it means to be an entertainer. And the Beatles were very much a band. They collaborated and wrote their own music. They presented aesthetically considered images of themselves. They consolidated the record album as more than just a collection of songs, but as a united band expression. And they even attempted to gain some control over their means of production, Apple Records. While such moves were not entirely unprecedented, together they initiated a new model of how to create and perform music. In this sense, the Beatles were a direct inspiration to countless bands that took such germinal practices and fulfilled them in their own unique ways. The progressive rock band Yes is such an exemplar, in part because of the uniquely strong aesthetic vision the band brought to all aspects of creative production, but also because of the way they provide a direct link to Wagner due to their instrumental virtuosity, which was considerable, and their deliberate attempts to cross rock and classical music. For these reasons and more, Yes are placed at a key point in the century since Wagner, illustrating how music can retain aesthetic continuities despite dispersion across different media forms, technologies, and contributing personalities. Thus, Yes present a case for understanding music today in an intriguingly evolutionary sense. For the purposes of this essay, we concentrate on a single album, Close to the Edge, as a striking example of the evolution of musical form and production that presents challenges to more traditional understandings of music, challenges that can help us grapple more readily with what we have rather inelegantly labeled postmodern, post-punk, remix, hip-hop culture. Yes, pioneer prototypical multimedia techniques, even while in an erstwhile musical setting, techniques suggestive of networking that in digital culture transform disparate media in an experiential world, revealing how compositional work is conducted and how it is received by an audience. First and foremost, we want to address the album's composition. We remark above that Wagner was quite successful and influential in transforming opera into a total dramatic presentation. While the music may have remained primary, other elements came to the fore so that, for the audience, a Wagner production was an intense and immersive experience. Yet for all that, Wagner remained quite caught up in the romantic cult of genius. He was the auteur, even if others were involved. Like Wagner and other classical musicians, Yes were virtuosic players, and they aspired to compositions that could only be achieved through virtuosity. And yet, at least during this time period, they, like many bands, resisted the lure of ego and put the music first, submitting themselves to group composition and seeing the music as greater than any individual. Second, in line with their precursors, the Beatles, the album was conceived as a unified aesthetic object. Not only did the songs share thematic unities, both lyrically and musically, but the album itself was implicated in complex networks of reference. For example, classical composers such as Sibelius and literary works such as William Blake's poetry and Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha, on which the title track is loosely based, not to mention the politics and lifestyle of the burgeoning Green Movement. We also have to point to Roger Dean, an English artist and architect famous for numerous album covers, including Yes's Close to the Edge. In fact, Dean, to this day, is most strongly associated with Yes, and in conversation, he spoke as if he were a surrogate band member. Dean originally sought to be an architect, and the futuristic, otherworldly landscapes he drew reflect that dream, as Yes were also creating unusual musical worlds and soundscapes. Dean went on to design complex stage sets, combining his visual art with architectural design. What is important here is the merging of media and the parallel mingling of communities of people. Visual artist and musical group come together to create an aesthetic object greater than each individual involved, one that is also a hybrid of conjoined, mutually interactive media forms. All this stretches us beyond the confines of Wagner's aesthetic vision and production, but we have one other consideration, compositional techniques. As reported by the band members, the recording studio and its technologies allowed for new ways to write music. One of the members, typically lead singer John Anderson, would bring in a snippet. The other members would begin to work with it, changing it, evolving it. In this piecemeal fashion, larger works would be built up, such as the 18-minute track, Close to the Edge. There was no original plan or overarching compositional goal. The work evolved out of itself in the shared artistic vision of the group. The producer and engineer, Eddie Offord, was also integral to the process, so much so that his picture appears on the album cover with the rest of the group. Especially important was his ability to edit master tape. Musicians have discovered that composing in a recording studio is a powerful process, yielding new sounds and processes for making music. The studio could also make music difficult to recreate live, and tape editing, as utilized by Yes, is a technological component that becomes so crucial to the composing process that the music could not have been made without it. We are not talking about the direct application of technology, such as using sound effects to change the sound and tone of the instruments, like distortion or echo, or to speed up or slow down the music, or create backward sounds. Instead, we mean that technology insinuates itself into the composing process, and in the case of Yes, this means the art as well as technique of the tape editing. Bill Bruford, the drummer, explains, quote, "Tape editing was fundamental to this band creating the music at all, because we couldn't play any of it through until we'd learned it. We'd play a 30-second segment and say, 'What happens now?' We'd stop the tape and write another 30-second segment. It would go on like that, like climbing Mount Everest." We see here a further evolution in the feedback model. If Hendrix was a master at incorporating feedback into this guitar style and making noise musical, then Yes were, among others like Pink Floyd's David Gilmour, pioneers in incorporating tape editing as a furthering of a basic feedback model. Indeed, we might label such a method proto-cybernetic composition. While this analysis has been fairly summary, we hope to have made clear the extent to which Yes pointed towards postmodern remix culture and the technologies that enable its music. Yes, as a group, brought an aesthetically strong vision to its music, diffusing the cult of the genius virtuoso in order to make music bigger than all of them, extending the composing process to include technologies like tape editing. But at the same time, they extended the notion of music to include visual art, such as album covers and stage design, not simply as an accessory, but as an integral element in their musical worldview. Yes, we're not just making music to listen to. Instead, music becomes part of a network of aesthetic elements that open up a world one can experience and interact with. Yes, at least at their peak, filled the promise of the Gestaltkünstler by bringing together disparate media elements to generate not just music as total art, but as an entire aesthetic world. What is crucial is that they do this as musicians. That is, their art form is not, for example, film, which by its very nature merges sound and vision, and thereby more directly invites comparison to world building. It is through the extension of what music is, across new media forms and their associated technologies, that artists such as the Beatles, yes, and numerous other pathbreakers in their wake, have come to be forerunners in techno-aesthetico production, and in doing so have initiated a transformation in what it means to experience and interact with such aesthetic production. However, Yes's accomplishments can still be understood as working within the cult of the virtuoso genius, as the trappings of that ideology remained in the myth of the group, and while they perhaps extended notions of composition, still they were very much of their time, which, in terms of our essay, means that this period was prior to the emergence of sampling and other forms of digital production and reproduction. We have so far discussed the notion of the total artwork as it has evolved through diverse media forms, technologies, and means of production, and have assessed the importance of feedback for challenging traditional, linear communication models, as well as pointing to the importance of technological advances. Yes's compositional reliance on tape editing can be seen as an early example of cybernetic production, but as we will see next when we turn to Brian Eno, this method had far greater potential, not to mention far-reaching implications for the future of sound. End of 3. Part 4. Brian Eno and Ambience, The Inner Experience Goes Out. Brian Eno is considered the originator of ambient music, although it's clear that he had predecessors who could also be so labeled. Regardless, Eno has given ambient music its highest profile, and he has discussed substantially the use of cybernetic compositional methods. While there is much to say about Eno, here we will limit ourselves to his compositional methods. In the making of his earliest ambient albums, Brian Eno explained that he spliced together, quote, two simple and mutually compatible melodic lines of different duration, end quote. He would alter their timbre with an equalizer or make other minor adjustments, but these were not the primary factors in the music's emergence. Instead, it was the systematic unwinding, that is, the recording of their playback of the different tape loops that generated the music. Eno thereby played the roles of planner and programmer and gave chance its role, so that ultimately he became an audience to the results. As in the case of Yes, tape editing was crucial, yet Eno went far beyond what they achieved in making tape editing not just a compositional method, but equally a compositional partner. In this way, Eno was highly innovative in creating music that distanced the human subject from the compositional process traditionally understood as the product of more or less direct control. Further, he expanded our locus of aesthetic concern beyond what is most obviously considered music, to incorporate various landscape or environmental elements. Certainly, we have come a long way from Wagner, and yet, some common elements remain. Eno typically saw his albums as coherent, integrated statements, thereby carrying forward the notion of the total work of art. One could see some of the extensive liner notes he wrote for a few of his albums as being a further continuance of that principle, in that our understanding of the composing process will further our enjoyment of or involvement with musical work. However, we see also a great dispersion of the work involved in creating the Gestaltkünstler work through technological means, to the extent that via cybernetic feedback loops the creator of the work becomes audience. Furthermore, we see a second form of dispersion so that the surrounding environs become part of the music as well. The artistic implications of dispersing the generative processes of composing through technological and environmental axes emerged gradually in Eno's work. At first, he considered it high-quality mood music. Next, he gravitated toward more specific applications, as the self-explanatory titles of albums like Ambient One, Music for Airports, and Music for Film indicate. Music for Airports was even played for a time in one of LaGuardia Airport's terminals, and these kinds of uses led to Eno's next move, Ambient Music for Art Installations, for which he has done several compositions, such as Thursday Afternoon. Additionally, in a manner not entirely dissimilar to Yes's aspiration to musical worlding, Eno composed several albums that evoke unfamiliar realms, such as Outer Space in Apollo, Atmospheres and Soundtracks, imaginary landscapes such as Ambient 4 on Land, and alternative worlds such as his collaboration with John Hassell in Fourth World, Volume 1, Possible Musics. Lastly, Eno, working with David Byrne of the Talking Heads, produced one of the first albums to rely heavily on sampling, My Life in the Bush of Ghosts, now recognized as an early and influential model for how everyday speech can be remixed for significant aesthetic musical impact. The entwinement of a startling array of media forms speaks to Eno's creativity, even as it disperses it into alternate compositional methods, technology simple and sophisticated, and diverse collaborations with musicians and found sound. Eno's innovations challenge our notions of what it is to compose just as much as they challenge our notions of what it is to listen or consume a musical work. It is as if on the mixing board of life, Eno turned down the active volume knob on the creator and turned up the active volume equally on the listener and the surrounding environs without ever adjusting the passive volumes for either. Such musical worlding, in other words, is not simply an experience we undergo. In experiencing it, we are transformed in our aesthetic sense of what music is and what it means to participate in music's unfolding. Consider, for example, two themes that have been working throughout this essay, feedback and total art. It is not enough to say that these musical features have histories that can be traced and techniques that can be described. Rather, insofar as they are networked to wider cultural and technological transformation, they emplace us differently as regards the aesthetic work. As John Hassell, in 1983, who frequently collaborated with Eno and utilized many of the same techniques, explains about one of his albums, like the video technique of keying in where any background may be electronically inserted or deleted independently of foreground, the ability to bring the actual sound of musics of various epochs and geographical origins all together in the same compositional frame marks a unique point in history. The ability to combine and remix in this manner is already to evoke a new world. Once we pass a certain limit threshold, the way of defining media across genres and/or technologies common to that previous time become obsolete, untenable. Those definitional boundaries and the practices that emerge with them blur, bleed, rearrange, become different than before. And as we have been arguing in various registers, sound, especially musical sound, is key to understanding how new media transform notions of literate practice, not just as a series of new technologies and techniques, but actively as a Gestempkunstwerk worlding us differently than before. To utilize feedback in music, then, is not only a technique emerging from a technology, it is also a new way of engaging the world, a world where feedback is a conceptual resource, a series of practices, a mode of fundamental understanding. End of part 4. Part 5, The Flaming Lips, quadraphonic ambience. Today, the techniques developed and advanced by Eno are not only common, but have been extended even further. Artists are still creating musical environments, as for an airport or art installation, but they are also seeking ways to blur the boundaries between performance and appreciation, playing and listening, production and consumption. The Flaming Lips stand as a contemporary example of the dispersal of the creative process into new, communal technological forms. In these artists' hands, ambience is not just mood music, but rock music of a newly participatory kind. Punk rock in the 1970s had already ushered in some of these ideas in its attempt to break down barriers sundering artist and audience by celebrating a do-it-yourself aesthetic, inspired amateurism, and increased audience interaction. The Flaming Lips filled opportunities for audience participation through experimental projects that nevertheless remain attuned to the band's original musical intentions. The experiments produce not only music, but also participatory, immersive experiences that have deep affinities with today's sophisticated digital and reproductive technologies and the techniques we see emerging. These experiments attend to the possibilities of bringing as many media forms together as possible, of heightening the total art experience, and of getting the audience involved equally as contributors to the music and effectively as part of the happening. If, as explained above, Eno was an audience to his own results, and thereby a key figure in seeing the dispersion of the singular composer as agent into multiple agencies, then the Flaming Lips take us even further, highlighting the most significant aspects of prosumer culture through their auditory and visual experimentation. In 1997, the Flaming Lips released Zerika, an unusual album in that its music was spread across four CDs meant to be played at the same time. Also included with the album was a postcard that explained that the Flaming Lips were, quote, conducting a series of experimental concerts in parking lots and banquet rooms, using car stereos and portable tape players, up to 300 pre-recorded and pre-arranged cassette tapes, and utilizing audience participation, they have created multidimensional surround sound events that are challenging the conventional ideas of what a concert can be, end quote. Before the release of Zerika, the Flaming Lips were experimenting with headphones, FM transmissions, and multiple sound sources, all of which required audience participation. The first were called the parking lot experiments and involved fans syncing tapes to their car stereos. Then came the boombox experiments, which asked audience members to control pre-recorded elements. Later, the experiment was conducted through headphones. Ambient sound was played underneath the pre-recorded elements, and these sounds interacted with the quieter, individually broadcast elements piped into the audience members' headphones. These collective experiments resulted in a decidedly prosumer feel to Lips shows that began to redefine what it meant to go to a concert, since they further blurred the distinction between live performance and recorded music, and between artist qua producer and audience qua consumer. The Flaming Lips were overcoming the limitations of the concert form by recapturing the experience of a happening. In this case, the happenings were also multimedia events, where the music was but one element in an immersive, total music experience, constituting yet another evolution in the Gestampfer's work. However, this discussion only begins to scratch the surface of the Lips' musical worlding, for technological innovation has a much larger role to play than we have so far indicated. The Flaming Lips continued their experimentation, as introduced in their boombox concerts, to include advances in audio technology, exemplified by the 2003 release Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots. It included a bonus DVD remix to take advantage of advances in surround sound to include all five speakers plus subwoofer of the Dolby 5.1 standard. The widespread dissemination of Dolby 5.1 as a standard assured Warner Bros., the label holding the Flaming Lips distribution rights, an ultimate copyright holder of the Lips intellectual property, that there would be equipment available to play what the band had envisioned. Dolby Technical Standard provided an avenue for the band's expression, yet it also served as a corrective to any technological determined sense of sound mixing. That is, Dolby 5.1 was integral to the distribution of the sound experiments the band was already producing, as on Zurika's multiple CDs and the parking lot and boombox experiments. But before and without Dolby 5.1, the Flaming Lips were producing groundbreaking, multiple-channel, audience-involved rock and roll. But the widespread acceptance of the Dolby 5.1 standard by music producers and distributors, coupled with the parallel marketing and purchase of modestly priced surround sound stereo equipment for home use, ensured that the Flaming Lips had a base of newly installed equipment, as well as curious audiophiles who were looking to take advantage of their multi-channel audio-video investments. It would be difficult to separate the Lips' experimental successes from these other parallel advances, and the DVD becomes an example of the Flaming Lips' appropriately chirotic response, a band taking advantage of a cultural moment where technology and desire aligned with their sound experimentations. These projects highlight the ways digital tools can make creation in multiple media forms available to aspiring auteurs, musicians, photographers, animators, and more. Equally, they speak to the necessity of an undergirding technological network that functions akin to a covalent bond in chemical reactions. This constitutes, with increasing importance, the second sense we ascribe to the term worlding. The experiments require the surrounding technologies to thrive, aesthetically and economically. The technologies open up the aesthetic realm within which the experiments can come into being. This realm also includes those who utilize these technologies. Since they are part of the network that feeds back into the band's performance, they are integral to the process. The band needs users and technologies in order to enact the performance and find in such experiments new cultural aesthetics and the strategies for achieving them. All these elements come together to open up the world of technological possibility, both in terms of production and enjoyment. The website description of the DVD version of Yoshimi does not mention one of the more unique features of the release, a feature we wish to highlight: frequency waveform cartoons. Above, we described how Yes pursued album cover art and stage design to further their musical worldling. Here we see yet another advance in this direction, this time rather directly achieved through technological mediation. The liner notes explain, quote, "These color burst patterns are designed by George to act as a kind of soothing visual companion while you are listening to the intense surround field. With each track, particular frequencies have been animated to bounce and pulsate according to the dynamics of the sounds within the song," end quote. Almost as an afterthought, the Flaming Lips invent and distribute a new and exciting addition to the sound, video, multimedia landscape. Rather than producing visuals to accompany the music, the DVD offers a data stream that presents a, quote, "soothing visual companion," end quote, on the screen while the music is playing. This visual companion is actually a machinic interpolation of the equivalent of an oscilloscope run through a flash interpreter. It translates sound frequencies into color, shape, and movement reminiscent of a 1960s multimedia slideshow, but at an intensity and digital mastery that Warhol and the Velvet Underground can only produce in imaginative or chemically enhanced trance. These frequency waveform cartoons, as the liner notes name them, are something we have not experienced before or seen in any other form. They are quite different from what Microsoft calls, and we assert are mislabeled, ambient video presentations in Microsoft Media Player, and similar tools that generate, quote, "visualizations." Indeed, these frequency waveform cartoons inspired one of the authors to design a living space around them. Although the screenshots presented here begin to represent the visual component of these frequency waveform cartoons, because of the limits of the static page and black and white reproduction, they necessarily fail to capture the combination of movement, surround sound, and code that makes the DVD such a magnificently integrative experience. A multimedia artwork looking back to Wagner's Gestapo's work, even as it pushes through towards something else. It presents a networked whole greater than the sum of its constituent parts, which requires the band not only to compose music, write lyrics, and play their instruments, but to paint images to accompany the songs, write minor notes, collaborate with mixing technicians, work with software and web development tools, and develop innovative uses for input streams, that is, what we now refer to as data streams. This last item, developing new uses, in turn allows programmers to devise visual output from sound input, revising still further the cybernetic diagrams we presented earlier. We must begin again to accommodate the various sources, transmitters, feedback loops, and output streams that multi- and hyper-mediated total art encompasses. Note in the diagram how the signals are simultaneously differentiated and conjoined. They are no longer mere feedback or noise, but crucial elements for the sound becoming mediascape. Contemporary artists, such as the Flaming Lips, who are working in digital multimedia, collapse distinctions among the source or native signal media and see sources simply as varieties of input generating new forms of output, varieties that can be marshaled together. Wayne Coyne described these technological musical composition crossovers. The new Flaming Lips album, he said, is like if Stevie Wonder got together with Led Zeppelin and they had Pro Tools. In the process of bringing together digital design tools with multiple media streams, the Flaming Lips offer examples of immersive new media environments that can be composed. What such innovation confronts us with is the growing sense that we may carry with us outmoded layers of media definition based on technological differences that no longer exist, at least not in the same way as before. In this regard, the Flaming Lips are at the forefront of those beginning to realize some of the implications of the liquidity of digital manipulation for media forms, where the formerly naturalized sense of genres, such as film or music, dissolve or morph. As Jean Baudrillard commented, "I think that it, new technologies, will no doubt explode in all directions, because this is a sprawling medium, and it will grow in all of the domains. But do the ends remain the same? That is doubtless the main problem." End quote. So it may be that the diagram is unnecessarily complex, because we retain in our minds habits and vocabularies, definitions that separate visual from video signal, computer signal from television, and telephone from radio. But as the Flaming Lips and others demonstrate, these are convenient, once plausible fictions that are changing more and more. In other words, distinctions between media are increasingly blurred. Even at the techno-material level, digital media are strings of ones and zeros, regardless of our ultimate perception of their differences, manipulated to create worlds in our imagination, without deference to whether they enter through our eyes, ears, or through pulses against our skin. Among other things, this elevates the role and importance of sound, even as it allows us to refocus and learn from sound manipulation and composition techniques. And, as digital signals do not differentiate by the media of transmission, digital tools for sound, such as GarageBand, blur the boundaries between producers and consumers of the signal itself. End of part 5. Part 6. Redefining authorship, redefining expertise. GarageBand 2.0. GarageBand is the name of a powerful Apple-created software program, already now in its third version, for composing and recording music. It is the latest program in a suite of Mac programs designed for using and manipulating digital content, including iMovie, iTunes, iPhoto, and iDVD. Collectively, these programs are known as iLife, a term that highlights the extent to which digitality, as manipulation and consumption of media forms, is marketed as a lifestyle. Despite the earlier programs with which GarageBand has significant similarities in interface design and operation, it is not an overstatement to claim that GarageBand is unique. The power of the program is such that one needs no particular musical or instrumental skill, nor even a way to input content in order to make music. The other iLife programs, by their very nature, require at the least that one provide some content, images, video, songs. While GarageBand is designed to work with outside content, it also comes with a large number of pre-programmed beats, riffs, and melodies with which one can work. The power of GarageBand is that it makes anyone, at least potentially, a composer. And the new 3.0 version integrates images and video with sound, making anyone a potential composer of multimedia. GarageBand's library of prefabricated sounds is limited naturally, but one can supplement it with jam packs, of which there are now at least 4. They provide thousands of additional rhythms, beats, riffs, and melodies for scores of instruments. Further, GarageBand allows for other forms of input, from real instruments and voices to samples and digitized instruments played through an interface bundled with the software. Indeed, GarageBand can handle and intermix nearly all forms of musical input as we understand them today. Once inputted, layered together, looped, mashed up, or otherwise assembled, in a word, composed, one can transform the work in still other ways, including changing pitch, tempo, time signature, tonal color, and so forth. The interface allows one to listen to the sounds while at the same time visualizing how the parts go together. GarageBand is significant for our article because it brings together rather concretely a number of the themes we have been discussing. First, it operates forthrightly on a feedback model. To compose on GarageBand is not so much a matter of drafting as revising. That is, one must continually move among and manipulate the layers through the interface's audio and visual feedback protocols. This feedback model is integral to the compositional work of GarageBand, and thus, we can see a direct link with artists such as Eno. Second, insofar as GarageBand is designed as digital production software, its purpose is to enable consumers to produce digital sound. While this is not unusual per se, the scope and power of the program is, at least for now, unique to the extent that it grants non-musicians great musical capacity. And of course, since the music is digital, it is potentially infinitely manipulable, reproducible, and distributable. This last point is worth underscoring because it brings us back around to the concept of worlding. We have discussed how Wagner and Yes approach the Gesamtkunst work whereby different media are integrated to fulfill and further the musical aesthetic. We then extended that discussion beyond this notion of the total artwork in order to understand how feedback loops set up among artists, audiences, and technologies become ingrained in the music and musical experiments. Artists are not isolated, that is, but they in turn depend on the availability of certain technologies and the aesthetic possibilities they open up, as well as audiences that are also attuned. In short, networked feedback loops are integral to musical production and experimentation, and when we step back to analyze how these visual musical works are generated, distributed, and received, we find that the works are in a very real sense inseparable from the complex modes of production from which they emerge. Worlding, then, carries this double sense. It is the aesthetic realm that a visual musical work invites us to enter, to immerse ourselves in, and it is the constellation of production pathways and inputs, people, communities, technologies, and networks that are simultaneously evoked with the specific aesthetic world. These two senses of world are tightly imbricated, if not inseparable. With the above in mind, we can see that GarageBand, by enabling even non-musicians to create, reproduce, and distribute music, is also worlding. It marks the latest step in the development of prosumer culture, where every act of consumption will in turn be an act of production. If we have learned nothing else from the great transformation of contemporary life, instigated by the advent of the World Wide Web, It is that the combination of infinite reproduction and distribution creates networked communities, and these communities in turn generate feedback, even noise, as songs are remixed and redistributed on the internet to be remixed again by others, which necessitates further transformation. Feedback, in other words, is the guarantee against stasis, the infinite promise that new compositions are inevitable. End of part 6. Part 7. Conclusion. We have argued that musicians have long been forerunners of techniques and concepts and possibilities common to contemporary digital multimedia production. We have advanced terms such as Gestamkin's work, feedback, prosumer, and worlding to show genetic links among artists as diverse as Wagner, Hendrix, Yes, Eno, and the Flaming Lips, and to demonstrate that new innovative software, such as GarageBand, can be seen as an outgrowth of trends going back decades. But where does this leave us? We suggest first that integration of media will continue. That is, as it becomes easier to generate and combine media, such recombinations, hybridizations, will advance, often in new and surprising ways, and, we assert, in ways we are unable to predict. Further, this integration will take place not only by combining different media forms, such as sound and image, but it will be increasingly produced, reproduced, and distributed through technologies, networks, and communities. Indeed, we might say that in some ways it is becoming more difficult to separate out these terms as they seem to presuppose each other. This interrelationship and interpresupposition of technologies, communities, and agencies is another fold in our sense of worlding. We would like to conclude with an anecdote that furthers our arguments, but does so by showing that we are only in a moment whose supersession can already be gleaned. First, prior to drafting the section on GarageBand, we spent an entire evening learning the software and composing on it. Feedback and remixing were crucial to the proceedings, as were networking and community. We made our fair share of noise, and some of it even made its way into the compositions. We did indeed feel fully our roles as prosumers. Nevertheless, the software, while relatively easy to use, stops short of being intuitive. It takes real work to use GarageBand, and not just the effective work one normally associates with sound production. These are not idle criticisms, for they show that as advanced and wonderful as GarageBand is, it can be still better, or even superseded. For example, in a website devoted to reviewing new media tools, Spencer Critchley discussed the use of music software from the perspective of an online community of musicians. What repeatedly came up were specific kinds of frustration, and their criticisms of GarageBand in particular are telling. Among the complaints leveled by the reviewers is the assertion that the interface is too complicated. It is hard to learn and to remember, and the learning that must take place is intellectual rather than musical. The review presents the critical perspectives of musical rather than technological experts, so it is especially significant to note the appeal to pathos. Quote, "The interface is not aesthetically pleasing as a design. It either doesn't look good or feel good to work with, or both. It's not lovable. Performance on the instrument may also be uninteresting as performance, as in the case of digital DJs hunched over laptops, looking, as one participant pointed out, like they're busy at a desk job." End quote. Note the emphasis on feedback and other affective factors. Apple, it should be noted, bills GarageBand as itself being an instrument. That is, when we are considering production from the perspective of digital life, that is, Apple's iLife, software is no longer limited to combining or transforming pre-existing content. Rather, it produces content itself no differently than a musical instrument. The complaints of the musicians indicate that they too take software like GarageBand to be an instrument. This is seen most clearly in the complaint that the interface design is ultimately displeasing and that it is not lovable. Perhaps here we see a key insight into what the future may bring, a more complete integration of technology into the affective realm, and thereby a further blurring of lines, distinguishing media from each other, as well as software from instrument. This also suggests that sound will increasingly be of greater importance in understanding what it means to compose in a world, and what it means to compose a world, and that techniques emerging from feedback-driven processes, the breakdown of the line sundering consumer from producer, innovative forms of input, and emergent networked communities of production and sharing will continue to be of the highest value.